To begin with, Jeroboam set up golden calves in the cities of Dan in the extreme north of his domain and Bethel in the extreme south of his domain. We read about that at the end of 1 Kings chapter 12. So Bethel became a center of idolatry. Despite that, Bethel actually had a long and famous legacy of religious significance in Israel. It was one of the two places where Abraham, for instance, upon entering to the land of Canaan, set up an altar there at Bethel. Later on, in Genesis, the 28th chapter, we find perhaps the most famous story associated with Bethel. And that was when Jacob, on his way to Aram, Paddan Aram, slept and had a dream in which he saw a ladder extending from the earth up into the heavens with angels going up and down the ladder. And the Lord at the top of standing at the top of the ladder. You probably know that story if you've been a Bible student or reader for very long. But it goes on from there. There are other events associated with Bethel. Bethel became something of a religious center. But of course, Jeroboam had turned it to evil purposes by setting up one of the two golden calves there. But because it was so famous in Israelite history as a religious center, there was even a school of the sons of the prophets there. There were some there in Bethel who were faithful to the Lord. They're called the sons of the prophets. That means they were students of the prophets. So you can imagine there are two competing religions in this city of Bethel. You have the school of the prophets who are faithful to Jehovah, and then you have the worshipers of the golden calf there. And they're very much opposed to one another. So in the time of the prophets Elijah and then Elisha, Israel was in a great religious crisis. Through the prophets Elijah and Elisha and others, God was struggling to bring the nation of Israel back to him in faithfulness. So the story here in 2 Kings 2, at the end of the chapter, which we read, is a story of Elisha's confrontation with those who are unfaithful to God, particularly these mocking young boys. And this story illustrates how religiously divided and degraded the state of Israel was. Now to look more particularly at the second chapter of 2 Kings. As I've said, Elisha replaced Elijah as God's chief prophet to Israel. At the beginning of 2 Kings chapter 2, we see that Elijah and Elisha are making their way down to the Jordan River, on the eastern bank of which Elijah will ascend up into heaven in a whirlwind. But on their way to the Jordan River, they stopped first at Bethel and then at Jericho. And at both of those two cities, Bethel and Jericho, it was prophesied by sons of the prophets that God would take away Elisha's master, Elijah. And then at the Jordan River itself, it appears, beginning with verse 17, that 50 sons of the prophets stood on the western bank and were able to witness the ascension of Elijah up into the heavens in a whirlwind. The Jordan River typically was not a very wide river. So those standing on the western bank would be able to witness what occurred on the eastern bank. After Elijah's ascension, 50 men conducted an unsuccessful 3-day search for him. It was thought that perhaps the Lord, even though he had taken Elijah, might have set him down somewhere and he could still be found. But he was not found. And then after this, Elisha seems to have stayed with the sons of the prophets at Jericho, even worked a miracle there, as we see beginning with verse 19. My point here is that there was plenty of time for the story, the news, the report of Elijah's ascension up into heaven to spread over the country, particularly back to Bethel. So, Elisha eventually makes his return to Bethel. He's on his way to the Mediterranean coast, particularly to Mount Carmel. And in doing that, he passes through or by the city of Bethel again. When he does so, or after he has done so, he is followed and mocked by a mob of young men or boys. I want us to look at a couple of the elements or aspects of their taunt, their mockery. First of all, note that they referred to him as bald head. I don't think we have any bald men here today, so I guess I can go ahead and say some of the things I had planned to say. Baldness is not something that tends to be appreciated. It indicates perhaps old age, maybe some physical problem. It might be a source of embarrassment to the man who becomes bald. I guess if we had a preference, we men, though oftentimes we cannot prevent it, we would prefer to retain all of our hair until the time we die. Often, though, that is not the case. It's a matter of biology, a matter of genetics, what have you. So this was not something that, first of all, Elisha could control. So there are two ideas then about how he might have been bald. Maybe he was naturally bald. If so, this would have been considered a physical defect, maybe a source of embarrassment to him. And you don't make fun of someone's physical defects. That's the wrong thing to do. That's why I said I'm glad we don't have any bald men here today. They might not appreciate the fact that I'm calling baldness a physical defect. But I'm saying that's the way people who are not bald, I guess, would look at it. But there is another interesting possibility I will submit to you as to why Elijah was bald. Elisha might have shaved his head, made himself bald as a sign of mourning over Elijah's, his master's, departure. He was not going to see him again on this earth. This would have been to him an occasion for mourning. Now, it's interesting that sometimes, in order to express distress or great sadness, in order to express mourning, men at that time would shave their heads. If that is the case here, that is, that Elisha had shaved his head as a sign of mourning over the loss of his master Elijah, then surely that was not something for them to mock at, to call him bald head for, because he was simply trying to express his sadness. Particularly then, if that was the case, they should not have been mocking or making fun of him for that. Then the other expression, go up, you bald head, they said. there are a couple of different interpretations given to the expression go up. First of all, it might have been simply a reference to the fact that Elisha was ascending upward on the road. And therefore, if they were telling him to go up for that reason, what they meant to say is, get out of here. Go on your way. Be gone. Good riddance. We didn't like Elijah. We don't like you. So he's gone. We want you to be gone out of their lives, out of our lives. That's one possibility, and it very might be the correct interpretation. But let me give to you another intriguing and interesting interpretation, sometimes given to the expression, go up. Some think that it might have been a reference to the fact that according to the report they had probably received in Bethel, it was claimed that God had taken Elijah up into the heavens, which is actually what occurred. But it may be, since these youths do not respect Jehovah, do not worship him, do not respect his prophets such as Elijah and Elisha, they might have been saying in disbelief, in effect, listen, you claim that your master Elijah ascended up into heaven? That's ridiculous. We don't believe that. And they scorned the very report that they had received of the ascension of Elijah. In effect, then, they were saying, we don't believe that report. We're scornful of it. And if that was really true, then why don't you do the same thing? You go up. You go up. Ascend into the heavens, just like your master Elijah did, if that report is really true. So in effect, then, they might have been scorning the very report of God's miracle in taking Elijah up into the heavens. Now, there are some things in this passage that support that idea. First of all, the scripture tells us that Elisha looked behind him at the boys. Now, that would suggest that Elisha had already made his way through or past the city of Bethel, and he was already on his way. He was leaving town. If that was the case, why then did they need him to tell him to go up? That's what he was doing. He was leaving the town, had left it indeed already. Also, it says, two female bears came out of the woods and mauled 42 of the youths. Now, where are woods? Typically, well, I know we've got some woods here, but this is not typical. Usually when you're in a small city, and Bethel was probably a relatively small city, houses adjoining one another and so forth, that's not where you're going to find woods or forest. The forest or the woods would be at least on the outskirts of a town, not within the town itself. But the two female bears who mauled the youths came out of the woods. That suggests to me again that Elisha had already left the town. So why then did they need him to do what he was already, or tell him to do what he was already doing? Furthermore, if they were simply telling him to go away or be gone, then there were words to say exactly that. And you can find those words in other places in the scriptures who were on the lips of people who were telling others to get out. So all of this suggests to me that there may be more in the words go up than simply be on your way. Get out of here. So there may have been then this allusion then to this mocking allusion to the ascension of Elijah. And they might have said, if this is really possible, if this really happened, then you also go up, ascend into the heavens like your master did. In any event, what we have here, and this is the picture that you need to get in order to appreciate what is happening and understand what happened, is that of a large, jeering, possibly threatening mob of young men who were following Elisha out of town. I say large mob. We know that 42 of them were mauled by the two female bears. That means there were at least 42. There may have been at least twice that many. It's not inconceivable that maybe hundreds of young men were following Elisha, jeering at him, even threatening to throw rocks and sticks at him. This is the picture that we need to see in order to appreciate why Elisha finally, he's on his way out of town, or he has left town, and they're following him, they're jeering at him, perhaps threatening him. He turned and cursed them. By the way, another point that would indicate that he was already leaving town, had already left town, is that these bears were able to catch and maul 42 of the youth. Now, in order for two to catch, that's what, an average of 21 per bear, 21 young men per bear. In order for those bears to catch them, that may mean they might have been at least a mile or more outside of town. This is how far, perhaps, that this mob of young, jeering men were following Elisha out of town. They might have actually intended to do him harm. Now, of course, some have condemned Elisha and by implication God, because God fulfilled the curse of Elisha by having these two female bears come out and maul these young men. Some have condemned Elisha and by implication God for being too harsh. They see these young men as just something like kids who are being childish, immature, misbehaving a little bit, mocking. Okay, they shouldn't do that, but is that so bad? Do 42 of them need to be killed for that? And by the way, it doesn't actually say they were killed. It says they were torn or mauled. Whether or not that means they died, I do not know, but possibly not. Let me observe, first of all, that the Hebrew word that is translated youth here, or youths, can refer to young men who are in their teens or even their 20s and 30s. So we don't need to think of little tots here, little, very little children who are in single digits as far as their age is concerned. Okay, these were probably at least teenagers. As a matter of fact, this word is used to refer to Joseph in Genesis 37 verse 2 when he is said to be 17 years of age. And interestingly, later on in Genesis 43 verse 8, it is used to refer to Benjamin, the last son of Jacob, the 12th son of Jacob. He is referred to as a youth, but yet at this time in Genesis 46 verse 21, we see that he has 10 sons. So he might have been into his 30s. I don't know, 20s, at least into his 20s here. So again, my point is we don't need to think of these as very little children. Probably boys is the idea here. Now the other word that modifies the word lads or boys or youths is the word little. By the way, this same expression is used, little children or little child in the singular, is used in 2 Kings chapter 5 verse 14 when it says that Naaman came up from the waters of the Jordan River where he had been told by Elisha to go and dip, came up from the waters of River Jordan, and his leprosy was cleansed from him, and he had the skin of a little child. Same expression, same two words in the Hebrew. So probably these youths are to be seen as teenagers and probably had reached the age of responsibility where they could be held accountable for their conduct. I'm just emphasizing, we certainly should not, don't need to think, and probably should not think of these youths as very little children. Furthermore, their misconduct was probably reflective of the attitude of their parents. These young people had probably been taught to disrespect God's prophets. No effort apparently was made by the elders or their parents to stop them from doing what they did. As a matter of fact, the parents and elders of the city who did not believe in Jehovah, did not worship him, may very well have encouraged this conduct. So this was a judgment not only upon the children, but probably also upon the unbelieving, fully adult members of that city of Bethel. All right, let's look at a couple of lessons that we can learn from this story then. First of all, we need to be impressed with the fact that the sin of disrespect, even irreverence, is very, very serious. God takes irreverence very seriously. We're told in passages such as Proverbs 1, verse 7, and Proverbs 9, verse 10, that the fear of the Lord, that is the respect toward God, reverence toward God, is the beginning of wisdom and knowledge. And really, obedience to God is based upon our reverence for Him, our respect toward Him. The converse is also true. When people begin to disrespect God, disbelieve in God, have no reverence or fear toward Him, then they're going to disobey Him, and they're going to disobey His book, His revelation, the Bible. And that's pretty bad for society. Because let me tell you, if a person does not first of all respect God, do you think he's going to respect you? Do you think he's going to respect a man? We have problems in our society. As human societies have always had problems. Those problems, those hurtful situations that are going on can be traced back to people's lack of respect for God. And so it was here. The fact that there is no indication that these boys did anything more to Elisha than mock him does not diminish the seriousness of their misconduct. Mockery, irreverence toward God and His prophet was not something to be looked upon lightly. Now, there were several factors that made their taunting, their mockery of Elisha, particularly serious. First of all, they mocked what was either, as I said, a natural defect or a sign of respect on the part of Elisha toward Elijah, who had just departed from this earth. Now, what is, or what might be, regarded as a physical defect in one's body, since it might not be his fault, should elicit our sympathy, not our mockery. Do we mock at people who are crippled, for instance? Do we laugh at them? Do we put a stumbling block in the way of a blind person and try to trip that person? That's the first one for me. I've never had my papers fly away before while I'm preaching, as far as I can recall. But no, we don't do something like that. We would think that's terrible. You don't make fun of people like that. And on the other hand, the boy's mockery is magnified in its seriousness. If Elisha had shaved his head as a sign of mourning over the departure of Elijah, do we mock people who are sad, who are in mourning because they just lost a loved one? Do we go to funeral homes and laugh at the mourners there? No, we do not. I say all of this to impress you with how serious it was for these boys to mock at Elijah or Elisha. Secondly, it was serious because Elisha or rather, well, at least Elisha was an older man, older than they were anyway. It was considered very, very wrong, a serious sin for people to mock or mistreat in any way older people. Proverbs 30 verse 17 and Leviticus 19 verse 32. According to the law of the Lord, you were to respect older people if you were younger than them. You were to rise up before the gray-headed. You were to have profound respect for them. In the first place, aging is not something we can prevent. Getting old is not our fault. That's not something to be mocked. And furthermore, older people who have endured the challenges of life and have thereby gained wisdom ought especially to be the subjects of respect. It's not so much the case today, but even I was taught to respect my elders. You don't laugh at an old person. You don't make fun of old people. You are gentle with them. You are respectful toward them. I'm not saying that old people can be right just because they're old. Old people make mistakes too. But at least we are respectful to them. Or at least that's the way it ought to be. And these youths were out there taunting a man who was older than they, perhaps at least twice their age. That should not have been done. Third, this was a serious mistake on their part because they mocked a prophet of God. Indeed, it was not only because Elisha was a prophet of God that they mocked him. They mocked him because, in other words, it was not just despite the fact that he was a prophet of God, I should have said, but it was because he was a prophet of God that they mocked him. That makes it very serious. Here is one faithful to the Lord on a mission for the Lord. And their response is to mock him instead of showing him respect for what his work that he was doing. Finally, as a sign of their unbelief, they might have mocked God's great miracle. If they meant simply to tell Elisha to go away, to get out of their lives, not to bother them, leave them alone to follow their false religion, that was bad enough. But for them to tell Elisha to ascend into the heavens and get out of their lives, as it was reported that Elijah had done, oh, that made it much worse. That made it much worse. In such a case, they would have been expressing unbelief and scorn toward the report of Elijah's ascent into heaven. And so, that made it doubly bad for them to be doing that. So, first of all then, what we need to learn from this story is that the sin of disrespect and irreverence is very, very serious. Second and last lesson we can learn from this is that the sins of youth are not to be taken lightly. There are times when young people who are engaged in misbehavior might be excused in that misbehavior because, well, they're just young people. They will grow out of it. It's not a problem. The old expression was, he's just sowing his wild oats. It's natural for young people to behave that way. So leave them alone, or at least don't punish them too harshly. Let me say in response to that, that the sins of a destructive lifestyle are often sown in one's youth. And that's why the scriptures call upon children to honor their father and their mother. It is in one's youth often that his permanent character is formed and set. Proverbs 22, verse 6 says, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Let's use the analogy of an arrow that is shot from a bow. If life may be compared to the flight of an arrow, then where that arrow lands depends on the direction in which it is pointed when it leaves the bow. We need to be concerned with the way that young people are pointed as judged by their conduct. Sin must be nipped in the bud. And for this reason, Scripture lays upon parents a heavy burden to make sure that they correct any disrespect in their children. And this is what is not what the parents of Bethel were doing. The parents and the elders of that city, apparently according to any indication we have in the Scripture there in 2 Kings 2, were not doing anything to dissuade or to stop these children from their mockery of Elisha. If anything, they probably encouraged it, maybe even laughed at it. The one whose course is set straight in his youth usually does not suddenly and permanently go astray only when he gets to his latter years. Now, someone may raise the example of Solomon, who in his youth was very good, but in his latter years went astray. Let me remind you, though, that it was in his youth when he made the mistake of marrying the foreign women who led him astray in his old age. The sins of one's youth are not to be the subject, then, of lighthearted banter or jokes or stories meant to amuse. I made mistakes in my youth. And when I look back upon them, it bothers me terribly. Even when I'm alone, I may become hot with embarrassment when I consider the sins of my youth. They're still serious, even when they're committed by youth. In a sense, even more serious, because they may set the course of one's life. So we need not joke about the sins of youth when we sit around the table and talk about our past. It is not something to be made light of. In conclusion, what these boys did reflected the sins of their parents, their city, and their country. This was not something they did spontaneously. It was something they did as a result of drawing upon the spirit of their countrymen and their fellow citizens. Their punishment then was really a lesson that was intended to be sent sharply to their parents and their elders and their countrymen. Look at what's going to happen to you. Something such as this. If you continue on your wayward course, get out of it. Get on the right track. Because what happened to them will surely happen to you if you continue with your own irreverence. Thank you.